Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's badlandsranch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
There's a lot on the line in a divorce. Your home, savings, maybe even your kids. So when you find yourself facing divorce and the unexpected directions it can take, you need a partner you can count on. I'm Rick Julius, a partner at Cordell & Cordell. Don't let divorce take more than it has to.
Offices in Philadelphia, Radnor, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Rick Julius, licensed in Pennsylvania only. Michelle Ferrari, licensed in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Online at CordellCordell.com.
And he turns to her and goes, "Is it weird for you now, Sophie?" It kills me every time.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
That being said, it was one of the weirder fights we've had. Like,
oh my God, I know.
Crazy, right? I mean, right? I still don't fully understand whether you were so drunk and stoned that you thought we had sex, or were you just making a joke and it backfired?
Honestly, I think it was just one of those things.
Hello, everybody. This is episode 142 of Wreckatopia. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
That's me.
And joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, doppelgangerinos.
Ooh, doppelgangerinos.
Gangerinos.
I like that. Today's big recommend is The One I Love from 10 years ago. I did not realize how long. That's 10 years.
A decade.
Once again, I'd like to welcome chat who are coming here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. And, does anybody have any small recommends? Aaron, you want to start us off?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Sure thing. I saw Wicked, and ooh, I'm going to recommend it. There are just some movies that you go to and you just feel in sync with and you're just going to love. Like, I couldn't see straight, 30 minutes into this movie. I was just in heaven. And part of that has to do with my love of Broadway theater, my love of musicals. There's something to me about Broadway-style singing that is both expositional as well as character development as well as soaring notes. Like, all of that works on me. And so something like this is just going to be a home run anyway. I will say it also has great performances, which helps. I think both Erivo and Ariana Grande are fabulous in this movie. I think, and even beyond their incredible vocal chops, I think it was a tall order to get a couple people that could not be in the shadow of Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel. Like, that's a big ask, and yet somehow I think they managed to pull it off. I also love that even though it's a part one, it feels like a complete story. It feels like a complete movie. Yeah, in general, I think we're all, the three of us at least, against part ones as a concept. But when it can feel like So, for instance, if this was the Wicked movie and there wasn't a part two, we'd be missing part of the Broadway play and the part of that story. But honestly, I think we have a full story here. There is an absolute progression of the protagonist in this this first half or whatever that I think works, and the ending works. Part of that, I think, has to do with Broadway shows having a built-in kind of intermission. And so they're used to building towards, you know, what it means to finish the first half. But man, I was soaring. I was floating above my chair on this one. I was having a good time. So
I gotta say, first of all, I know nothing about this show. I don't know the music. I've never seen the Broadway show, so I'll be going in completely blind, which is probably good. But I am really disheartened to hear all the reports of auditoriums full of people singing along to this movie.
Mm.
And then Dwayne The Rock Johnson comes out yesterday and flat out tells people going to see Moana 2 to sing their hearts out. You paid for your seat. You're going to a musical. You love the music. You sing. And I want to punch Dwayne The Rock Johnson in the face. This is why I don't go to movies.
I would pay
anymore
to see that. This should be the next Netflix big fight.
It would be like
Jeremy and
did you ever see MacGyver punch somebody in the face? Because that's what it would be. Like, he punched somebody in the face and be like, ow, my hand is broken now.
Yeah. And he probably would be unfazed and not even hit you back because it's
he'd probably offer me
honestly, it'd probably be like punching a rock.
Anyway, don't sing in an auditorium full of strangers, people. But yeah, this movie seems like it's getting great reviews. So
I watched this in an auditorium where people were not singing.
Yeah, so, mine either. Nobody was singing in my auditorium.
I think that's possibly an overblown thing that, like, you know, that maybe a few auditoriums out in the world, there's people singing, but, you know, it's probably not the norm, I'm going to assume.
I hope
I enjoyed it too. I agree with Aaron on this, even though I'm not a big part one guy. I think when I saw this musical for the first time last year, and I thought it was really good, and it does have a very natural ending part, for it and everything. So, it's one of those things where if you didn't know that this was the middle of the story, then you'd probably walk out of the theater going, oh, that was good, or that was really good, you know. And but because we know that it isn't, we say boo to the part one, boo to the part one. This is one of the few times, though, that I have watched one and I've said, yeah, that's actually a really good ending, because defying gravity is such a number that it's one of those that, like, the rest of the movie would probably fail to live up to it a little bit afterwards.
Yeah.
I think the second half of it is great, but, you know, after that, you're going to be sitting there. There's that natural letdown after such a big number. So I think it's kind of good that there's, like, some space to be had in there. So, yeah, I'm along with Aaron on this one.
Nice.
Jeremy, what do you got?
I have an extremely large and swarthy small recommend that goes by the name of Lawrence of Arabia.
This was a big recommend while you were gone.
Oh, it was?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You guys big recommended a four-hour movie?
We sure did.
Aaron did, not me. I had nothing to do with it.
I was going to big recommend this, but I didn't want to put that on you, so I made it a small recommend.
Honey Badger don't care.
No, it's
no
fine.
Idea.
There was another period. There was another time while you were gone. Aaron small recommended something we had big recommended when he wasn't on the show.
So yeah. Okay.
Go all for right. it.
Well, I had never seen this. This is one of those stack of shame movies for me. Classics that I probably would not have watched had I not sat down, turned on the TV, flipped channels, and saw that it was just starting. And so I watched it. One of the reasons I have never watched this movie is because it's 3 hours and 45 minutes long, and I had such a bad experience with Dr. Zhivago that when I think a movie looks boring, I just assume it's boring, and I stay away from it. And Lawrence of Arabia has always looked boring to me, whereas in reality, it's fucking riveting, and it doesn't feel like 3 hours and 45 minutes long. And it's a fascinating character study of what war does to a man or a woman. And I think it would, when you guys did this, did anybody double feature it with Civil War?
I'm not sure if Civil War was out then or not, but I don't think so.
I kept thinking about Civil War while I was watching this movie because the themes are very similar to me and what war does to an individual, how it changes them in a way that they can't recover from. Like, by the end, Lawrence realizes he's become a bloodthirsty monster, but he can't change it. It's too late. So, yeah, acting through the roof. What sounds boring, a trek across the desert a couple different times, ends up being really, really engaging. And, yeah, it's called a stack of shame because sometimes when you watch these things, you realize, oh, shame on me for not having gotten to this sooner. So it's on Max right now if you want to watch it.
Yeah, I was looking at our list here, and apparently I double featured this with Dances with Wolves, which is also a long movie.
That's a good one, too.
But yeah, that's where I went with this because yeah, it's one of those where, you know, you have the white guy who goes native or whatever, right, and all that type of stuff. And so like that was what, but Civil War would have been a good one too. I think Civil War probably had come out by this time cause it came out early in the year and we did this over the summer, I think, but would have been a good double feature with this as well. You're absolutely right.
We'll talk Civil War eventually if it hasn't already been big recommended.
Nice.
Okay.
Love that tease. Yeah. So, this took place when we were highlighting for a few weeks there movies that everybody told us we were wrong about, because the first time I watched this, I was bored and I was just not in the right mindset. And then when we reviewed this, I kind of pulled a fast one with my description of the movie and did my plot synopsis as if I still didn't like it. And then at the end just said how much I loved it the second time. Because it was amazing to revisit this and to go, oh, I was completely wrong about this movie. It is so good. That was a fun discussion.
Yeah, and Lawrence of Arabia is one of those I feel like gets better and better every time I watch it. I've seen it like 3 or 4 times now. And especially now that there's like the big 4K beautiful edition of it and everything, it's just like the cinematography in that movie is so unreal.
Yep.
It's so unreal. All right, mine is not nearly as grand and epic. It's kind of weird to start to small recommend this one, but mine is My Old Ass, movie starring Aubrey Plaza and mainly Maisie Stella, who was best known for Nashville before this. But this was directed by Megan Park, who did The Fallout. I know a lot of you know The Fallout.
Oh yeah.
This is a sort of a coming of age story, although some of the coming of age tropes have been like written out of this, which I really, really enjoyed. This is about a girl over the summer who is approaching towards the end of the summer, and she's about to go to college, and so she wants to have a fun time and everything, and so like she and her friends go off to some secluded place to do mushrooms, and they do the mushrooms, and suddenly she is confronted with her older 39-year-old self, who proves that she's her 39-year-old self by some various things that only she would know and everything like that. And by the end, Aubrey Plaza ends up telling her, don't fall in love with Chad. Don't do anything involving a guy named Chad. And of course she runs into Chad the next day.
I would think don't do anything with Chad is good advice for everyone, right?
Yeah. But you haven't seen this Chad. This Chad is so lovable. And so cool, and so you're all gonna fall in love with Chad in this as well. Another kind of a star making performance from Percy Hines White, who plays Chad in this one. But it's about her meeting him and sort of falling in love with him, and there's a sort of crazy thing that happens where she's able to still talk. So like she thinks it's kind of a mushroom hallucination, and then she's able to kind of communicate via her cell phone to her old ass throughout the whole thing. And they keep on like sort of like having, you know, her younger self is finding about our old self and trying to figure out like, is that something that I want to do? And the old self is always giving her advice about what to do as her young self. And one thing I like about this movie, is that it's not one of those where they give this virginal character, like, you know, like, oh, she's having sex for the first time or whatever like that. No, this girl fucks, man. This is one of those things where it's like no apologies. She's like at the very beginning, she's attracted to this woman at the beginning who's going to be like, who's going to leave for the summer or whatever like that. She has a summer job. And she's like, I want to tell that girl that I love her. And like immediately the next day, they're like having sex on a boat. And it's like, yeah, man. Like a lot of times these coming of age movies, they make it a big deal about, oh, that's their first time or they've never done this before and all that. Not this movie. This movie's like, no, she's already engaged in sexual activity. Let's not make that a big deal. And so that's what this movie does. And so I really, really enjoyed that part of it. Anyway, this is a really, really, really good movie. I was surprised, actually, at how good this was. I thought this was going to be kind of a everyday indie movie that we've seen before, and I really, really enjoyed it. So I thought it was good.
I tell you what, all you had to tell me was that it was from the woman that made Fallout, and that sold me completely, because I love that movie. So, yeah, this goes up the list immediately.
I'm on the same page. I was surprised how much I loved this movie. This is one of my favorites this year. The performances are great, and that's, you know, going to be a huge part of it. I just wasn't expecting it to go some of the places it went, and it made me think about some things, I really appreciated this. Without getting too much into detail, I will say it makes an interesting double feature with the movie Arrival. They would work well together.
I was thinking of Arrival exactly. I was thinking that exact same thing watching this movie. Yep. I was like, this would be a beautiful Arrival double feature.
Yep, absolutely. the look on Jeremy's face.
Okay.
Did that move it down the list or up the list?
The synopsis of the older person telling the younger person what they should and should not do should tell you.
No, okay.
I guess the way these movies are presented, it would be a weird double feature. Always come up with good double features sometimes where I'm like, you know, like last week I was like, Avatar would be a good one for, you know, and it's like, yeah, but Avatar would just swallow this movie whole and whatever. So I get it. Like if watching those movies back to back, different presentations, I would say.
But you're absolutely right. This movie isn't interested in the same old coming of age tropes. It's just not interested in the, oh no, now I'm going through, it kind of picks up at the end of a coming of age movie in some ways, where it's like that second part of coming of age where you've gone through the weird, oh, adolescence, what is this kind of thing, and are now going to the, oh, adulthood, what is this kind of thing. So it's kind of like stage two of coming of age. So I loved it. It's a great movie.
All right. Now on to our big recommend.
Why do so many dogs die before their time? Actress and dog activist Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete by Badlands Ranch is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including premium protein-packed beef, nutrient-dense organ meat, heart-healthy salmon, gut-healthy vegetables, and several superfoods vital to your dog's health. And because high-heat cooking can add unhealthy things to your dog's food, Superfood Complete uses air drying, so it gets cooked low and slow. This means it has the convenience of kibble, but the health benefits of whole foods. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible benefits, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 right now to get up to 50% off your order and a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's badlandsranch.com/save50 today. All dogs are unique. Your dog's results can and will vary.
The holiday season should remind us that faith and family are the most important things in life. I'm Rick Julius, a partner at Cordell & Cordell. We hope that you succeed in coming together this holiday season with those you love to create wonderful memories. Holidays have this magical power to magnify small things into ever greater memories over time.
Offices in Philadelphia, Radnor, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Rick Julius, licensed in Pennsylvania only. Michelle Ferrari, licensed in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Online at CordellCordell.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
And I'm going to let Aaron take this one away. It's the one I love. So, yeah, Aaron is the one I love.
Oh,
go ahead.
Thanks. Oh, that's so sweet. The one I love is a 2014, 10 years ago film starring Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss that you've likely never heard of, even though it made over $500,000 at the box office. Half a million, guys. $500,000. So, who knows? The movie starts with some marriage therapy narration. From Ethan, played by Duplass. Talking about the night he and Sophie, played by Moss, met. They apparently fell in love by ditching a party to trespass swim in someone's pool, and that's how marriages are made. Then later in the marriage, Ethan and Sophie decided to try and recreate the experience on their anniversary, but no one came out to interrupt them, so that made Sophie feel like she was in a very sad metaphor. Then we see Ted Danson is their therapist, and also that he puts a lot of stock in how random piano notes relate to relationships. We get an overall sense that they're struggling to find their way through their marital discontent. So Danson grabs a pamphlet that is for a place he highly recommends they do a couples retreat at, except with much less Vince Vaughn and sexual harassment yoga. They eventually arrive to the house and start exploring. It's nice. It has a beautiful layout, a pool, a recording studio of some sort, and a guest house. Sophie also brought some weed, and they seem to be on their way to rekindling some fondness for each other. Sophie then heads to the guest house to explore that and finds a Russian nesting doll. She drops it and notices that Ethan has followed her here. He tells her he's excited to try new things with her in life, so it's time for some sex and some grape tossing.
That's right.
Which are different things, you pervert. He then says they should spend the night in the guest house, so she heads back to the main place to get some PJs. But what's that? She sees Ethan is now pretending to sleep in the main house. But is he pretending? Sophie can't figure out how he got there so fast, so now Ethan seems to be gaslighting her about not remembering the sex they just had. She gets upset and heads to bed, but Ethan heads to the guest house to see what happened. He smokes a joint and falls asleep on the guest house couch. Sophie then cuddles up with him and they fall asleep together. The next morning, Ethan wakes up hungover, but Sophie is all wakey-wakey, eggs and bakey, and he's starting to enjoy the pleasant conversation until he realizes something's off because Sophie doesn't like it when he eats bacon. He then heads back to the main...
What the hell, Sophie?
That's right, Sophie. He then heads back to the main house where Sophie somehow is still at. So he drags the much more perturbed version of his wife over to the guest house to see what's going on. And to his surprise, the house somehow no longer smells like bacon. He's clearly feeling something weird is going on, so he gets into scientist mode and enters the house alone to see what happens. And lo and behold, Sophie is now showering and needs a towel. He runs back outside to tell Sophie, and she clearly thinks he's lost his mind. But when she goes back in, Ethan is doing sit-ups on the floor and not wearing his glasses, which he may have mentioned earlier was a total turn-on for her. She seems to be taking a bit more time in the magic guest house than Ethan, so he decides to go in after her and realizes that the magic also apparently locks the doors and makes the glass impervious to rocks. Sophie finally comes out and the freaked out couple packs up and leaves, of course. The end, movie over. Nope. They stop for some non-bacon breakfast, and Sophie plays Jack to Ethan's Kate and says they have to go back.
Jesus.
She convinces him that maybe this is part of the growth, and so they head back to the magic house of bacon. Ethan takes the first crack at it and goes into detective mode again, asking questions and coming to the conclusion that Sophie too, or Fofi, as I now have dubbed her, believes she is Sophie. When he tells Sophie one this, she doesn't want him to spoil the magic trick, so they decide maybe it's time for some rules. Rule number one, no sex. Rule number two, no spying. Rule number three, be honest. And finally, rule number four, if either person says they're uncomfortable and wants to leave, they will leave. So now it's Sophie's turn for her 15 minutes in heaven. So Ethan sets his phone timer and she goes in to see Ethan too, who will now be E-Twin, listening to classical music and painting a portrait of her that she thinks is a little severe. Ethan 1 sees that 17 minutes have gone by and is clearly getting nervous. Meanwhile, Sophie 1 and E-Twin are bonding over cocktails and the ability to call each other the B-word. Ethan 1 is now at 22 minutes, so he can't help but break the spying rule and sees E-Twin giving her a massage. He gets caught, and after some light arguing, they get some dinner and talk about how E-Twin is funny and has more beachy hair. After retiring for the evening, Ethan says he's going to take his session, but instead, he plants his phone in recording mode in the guest house to see what Sophie is up to. The next day, Sophie and E-Twin are having some deep philosophical Matroska conversations, but they're unrecorded on Ethan's phone because apparently Fofi found it and is now just all static on the phone. Then Ethan has some shirts go missing and realizes that E-Twin is now sending hey you up texts to his wife. We then see Sophie with E-Twin again, and this time she drops a doozy. She asks him why he cheated on her, and apparently his answer is so perfect that she immediately bangs him. Later, Ethan is hanging out in the Orange Grove and gets a series of voicemails from friends and family that he is apparently calling them and asking for personal info at all hours of the night. Ethan is understandably freaked out, but has one more experiment in his bag of tricks. He fakes going out to the store, but then runs back to the guest house to enter it at the same time as Sophie so he can pretend to be E-Twin. When he does, he realizes that Sophie has been connecting deeply to E-Twin in a wide variety of ways. So sad Ethan takes it out on Fofi and tells her that she's a fake. But Fofi seems convinced there's something deeper going on than just this weekend. Later, Sophie heads out for some more personal time with E-Twin, but seems a little curious about his clothing choices. No matter, they start to make out and are rudely interrupted by the actual Ethan pounding on the door. But E-Twin has now disappeared, and all that's left is Sophie's declaration that she's decided to stay with E-Twin instead of Ethan. They argue all the way into the house before realizing that E-Twin and Fofi are now sitting together with them in the main house, and it's time for a four-way conversation. Ethan gets cleaned up for dinner, and a conversation starts about whether it's easier to buy an aardvark or a gorilla, and how electricity freaks animals out, or something. The whole thing is supposed to help Ethan and Fofi just accept that this is real, like totally real, and they should just go with it. A bit later, the two S's have a pleasant conversation until it isn't anymore, and S2 shows that fake kitties got claws. The night progresses onto some very boring and oversimplified five-card draw, and then, with who knows how many Skittles on the line, things get heated up as E-Twin spills the beans that it was actually Ethan Prime who snuck into the guest house yesterday for some recreational friction. This somehow, and also, of course, hurts Sophie so much she requires him to sleep elsewhere. Ethan then calls the therapist and leaves a message thanking him for this nightmare before spotting Chekhov's recording studio again. So he pops in to see what's going on in there. Turns out there's all sorts of folders in that computer of different couples who seem to be learning about themselves. He then finds the Ethan and Sophie file and a couple who are somehow transforming their voice to sound like him and his wife. And not only that, he and Sophie's review and picture are already up on the guest house guest book. So what is going on? Ethan is now locked inside the guest house and can do nothing about it. The next morning, Fofi drops by to spill all of the tea and let him know that she and E-Twin are actually trying to split them up so that they can leave together, but that E-Twin has accidentally fallen in love with Sophia Prime, and only two people get to leave, and that it might now be E2S1 instead of S2E2. And now I just wish the couple had been named Ruth and Dave instead, because that would have been a really funny Star Wars joke just now. Anyhow, while Fofi, who is now dressed the same as Sophie, stalls E-Twin by pretending to be Sophie, Ethan sneaks a conversation with the real Sophie for one last heartfelt plea to stay together. And it must have worked, because when E-Twin breaks in for a little same-versus-same finale fighting and asks Sophie Prime to leave with him, she doesn't. So E-Twin makes a dash for the exit, but gets knocked out cold by sudden force field. Ethan then tells Sophie they need to leave, so she smiles, and they leave the mystical therapy house happier than ever. Sometime later, they are enjoying some morning laughs together when Sophie decides to make Ethan some breakfast, and then she says she's making bacon, leaving Ethan wondering if this is the same Sophie who is now willing to make him bacon, or if he brought home the new Sophie who had made him bacon before. Now resigned, he seems to know that whichever Sophie it is, he can be happy, knowing on any given day that he's only one degree of separation from having bacon. And that is the one I love. Chris Jeremy!
This fucking guy.
Jesus Christ.
What did you guys think of the movie?
Go ahead, Jeremy.
Oh, you bastard. I think I'm going to need more than 24 hours to tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
My initial instinct is that I didn't love it, although I liked a lot of things about it. It's also very weird to binge all of The Good Place with my wife for 2 weeks and then turn this movie on and see fucking Ted Danson's face. that was bizarre. I think it asks more questions than it answers, and I think that's probably why the people who dig it, dig it. I feel like it needs one or two more answers for me to really connect with it. There's no question about, like, that's the fake Sophie at the end, right? Like, is there any doubt? Because let me see what I wrote here.
I'd say I'm almost sure, but I don't think there's, like, proof. Like, I could see somebody arguing.
Her because she's smiling at him while the other Sophie is looking down at the dead fake Ethan with a sad face. Mm-hmm. But the fake Sophie had just had revealed to her by the fake Ethan, God, this is complicated, that he loved the real Sophie more than her. So I don't think she would be sad that he's dead. I think she was devastated, and that's why she was able to look at the real Ethan and smile. Like, to me, I don't think there's any doubt, and maybe that's just my interpretation. But
so, question:
pretty clear.
Did I miss evidence that he is dead? I thought he was just knocked out.
Okay, knocked out or dead? No, I mean it doesn't really matter. Okay,
because dead is different. Like if they know he's dead, that does change a little of the dynamic there at the end.
No,
I assumed he was going to recover.
I'm just saying, fake Sophie or Fofi, as you called her,
yes,
would have no reason to be upset that he's on the ground.
Correct.
She is angry at him. She should be fine with this. So that's why I thought it was pretty clear. But again,
I think so too.
Okay, good. yeah, I mean, I would like to know what's happening. I just don't think the movie gives me enough to formulate a theory about what's happening.
Okay.
I think that's why it was hard for me to fully connect. But it was riveting from beginning to end because I never knew what was going to happen next. And I think the two performances, the four performances, I should say, by the two actors are incredible. So
nice.
Yeah, I mean, does this need one or two more questions answered, or one or two fewer questions answered? That's sort of where I'm at. I'm going to just stay off right off the top. I enjoyed this movie. So anything negative that I say after this is just stuff that, you know, I was saying, this is what I would like to see more than what they gave me. But I was a little disappointed that they did explain the fact that there were couples that were coming here and then changing into the incoming couples and then breaking those couples up and then leaving afterwards and all that. I was not on board with that whole thing there. I think it's interesting. I just don't think it makes me enjoy the movie anymore. And the movie's theme seems to be, hey, don't investigate, just go with the magic. Or at least it's that one part of their relationship that Sophie hates about Ethan so much, is that he's the investigator and whatever. And that's, I guess, up to the viewer as to whether the movie thinks that same thing or if whether, you know, it's just Sophie's hang up. But to me, it's better. The movie is better if there's just another couple that's, they're fake or they're digital or whatever, that just seem to kind of act like them. Because it feels like the movie's trying to tell me that running into your old self or your idealized self or whatever in a relationship is something that you might crave, but you're never going to get. And in this case, you can get them if you want to. And I didn't really like that. I thought they were going to learn something about their relationship that didn't involve going off with the other people in the end of it. Like, you don't have to make it a happy ending. You can still, you can still have them go over there and find out, okay, these are fake people. And then you find out whether or not you want to stay in this relationship at the end, because obviously the idealized Ethan is over there in that house. But I was hoping that she would just realize that and then be like, okay, well then I don't need to be with Ethan anymore. It does raise a lot of interesting questions about what happens to the couples afterwards, because I do believe the switcheroo has happened at the end. Sophie has once again decided to go out with or be with someone who's a liar, just an absolute liar. Like, he's ideal now, but he's not going to be ideal later. And I don't know if the movie explores that too much. He's also someone who has cheated on his wife, so to speak. She's going after another cheater. That's something that maybe by the end of it, you're like, okay, I get it. That's what the movie was trying to tell me, but it feels like it needed to be explored just a little bit more too, by the end. So, I enjoyed this movie. A good premise can hook you all the way through, and make a movie worthwhile by the end. But then sometimes you're like, I want to explore some things in here that I wish that the movie had more time to deal with. And from what I understand, a lot of this movie was improvised. There were like some parts in there that they wrote as sort of like an idea of what to say, but they improvised most of this movie. The director of this movie is Mary Steenburgen's son, and so, like, they're using Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen's house for the filming of this, which I thought was really interesting throughout this whole thing. But one other thing about this movie that I would say is a negative is its depiction of physical space and the geography of this main house and the guest house. It's really hard to understand that Sophie goes into that guest house at the beginning.
Yep.
I know it's all dark. I know it's different from the guest house. The guest house has, they portray it a certain way. You know, they open the door that goes into that living room and the couch is there. In the guest house, they open it up and they're like kind of in the kitchen and there's a stairway that goes up above it and all that. But if they're just being shot like a one head on a couch type of thing, you're like, where are they?
Yeah.
Who is this supposed to be right now? Is that Ethan 1 or Ethan 2? And I don't think the whole switcheroo thing, the whole confusion thing, is supposed to happen until the very end of the movie. I don't think they ever mean for you to be confused during the movie who is who in that whole thing. So a lot of times I had a lot of trouble figuring out, how did he get over there? And I had to rewind it and had to give the movie a benefit of the doubt when he goes over there to spy on her. And was it So he goes over there and he opens the door at the same time as her, and then they have sex, and then he goes back in the car and drives off, and then she's there at the main house afterwards. And I was sitting there going, but didn't he just leave? And then I had to think, oh, okay, he probably waited for her to leave to get back to the main house before he went downtrodden with the, you know, the Peanuts music or the ding, ding, ding. going back into the, you know, the going back into the car and driving back and everything. So I had to, like, I was like, wait a minute, but didn't he just have sex with the real Sophie and now she's back? Where are the groceries and all that type of stuff? And I was like, I was having a hard time because of the speed of which everything was going on, like, yeah, figuring out who was who. So that was another thing that I was having trouble with throughout the movie. Some good things though, I did enjoy. After they first realize the nature of this guest house and everything, and they go to that cafe, Elizabeth Moss is going, so what is it, like another dimension? And they're just talking about it very frankly, like not weirded out by it, just discussing it like adults, you know, like, you know, is that another dimension or something? I did enjoy the interactions there, and I don't know, man, the way this movie's perspective is, it seems like Ethan Wan is a piece of shit. I never really liked him one bit. I didn't think he was redeemable at one point, and I was trying to figure out if the movie was trying to make it like that. Was there a balance here? Usually relationships, especially in movies, point out the foibles of both characters, and I guess Sophie has some foibles, like she's a little bit too critical of him, I guess, but like it just seemed like Ethan Wan was just kind of a piece of shit the whole time, and I just didn't really care for him the whole time.
It opens in therapy with him basically saying, yeah, I cheated on you, but I've already apologized. Do we have to keep talking about that's a piece of shit, at least in that?
Yeah. Exactly. And then this was very true to life. I really enjoyed this part. But this is such a true to life thing. They tried to recreate their pool moment, their pool first night pool moment, and it just didn't work out. Like Groundhog Day, basically, where they were trying to do that whole thing where and then she's like, well, you know, it just wasn't the same or whatever. And this is such a true to life human reaction, and he's such an asshole when he does this. And he's like, okay, fine, I'm sorry, I tried to make a romantic moment. Mm-hmm. You know, I won't take you to a pool again.
Yeah, I'll never do that again, I guess.
And she goes, don't be like that. And I was so glad she just said that one thing, and that was enough to fucking shut his ass down. So yes, I enjoy this. The premise of this movie is fantastic. I think it needs some more molding or whatever, but that's the Duplass way, right? Yep. These mumblecore kind of movies or whatever. I don't even know if you would qualify this one as mumblecore, but his kind of like his production, it's kind of like, well, let's just do whatever we're thinking in the moment, and we put it out there, and if it's good, if it, you know, if it resonates with people, great. If it doesn't, great. We'll move on to the next movie, because you know he's making 5 movies right now as we're talking.
So. Yeah, you're not wrong.
I want to touch on something that I think you were kind of hinting at or overtly saying, and I'm just going to use different words. About halfway through this movie, what I thought we were going to see happen is both of them realize they didn't need or want idealized versions of each other. They wanted each other, warts and all. In fact, it was very much thematically reminding me of Inside Out 2, if that doesn't sound too weird, where at the end of Inside Out 2, they essentially realize we can't just take the bad memories and hide them away. They happen. That's part of how we became who we are. So we have to embrace all of it. And the movie, I think, ends up being more interested in the sci-fi and the twisty elements than a traditional relationship movie would. So I was a little disappointed we didn't end up there, because I thought that's where we might be going. And it takes them for freaking ever to realize the doppelgangers are idealized versions of their partners. It takes them forever. It was
well, and that was the other thing too, was that there's not enough experimentation here for me either. Like, he throws that rock and it clearly, to me, hit the top of the door. It didn't hit the window. And I know why that is in real life. They didn't want to actually smash the freaking window, but he doesn't try it anymore after that, that one shot. And he's like, all right, done with that. Don't have to do that anywhere again. And when they go back, they don't try to go in at the same time. They just say, well, only one of us can go in at a time. So therefore that's what we're going to do with it now. And they don't try to like both enter at the same time or both explore the house together or anything like mm-hmm. that. It's just kind of like, they already agree to the rules of the movie before they realize that what they really are. Mm. So there you go.
Is there not a scene where they both go in the first? Like, I know it seems like she goes in, has her experience. He goes in, has his experience. And then they both try to go in together and nobody else is there. Is that?
Yeah, because the bacon smell is gone.
Yeah. No. The bacon smell is gone. Yeah.
Oh, so, they do that.
Yeah. Hmm. So look.
But they don't do that until, after they've agreed to what they were going to do, though.
Right. No, that's right before no, that's that. Before. He goes in. Before? He's like, he's like, the bacon smell is gone. And she's like, what are you trying to say? And then, And then they come out and
go in separately
again, see their doppelgangers in the shower and then doing sit ups and then go have the conversation about what the rules are. Yeah, I think is how it goes.
Okay. There still needs to be some experimentation there, though, I believe.
I want to talk for 3 hours. This is one of those movies that, like, I would love to have these conversations. And I know this, you know, we don't have, but a few minutes to do it. But what I find interesting, and again, the reason a movie like this is going to appeal to me is, you know, oftentimes when we'll review something, we'll spend a lot of time on, you know, performances and script and, you know, these things that make movies great. And in both of your responses were about the metaphors and the meanings and is it a sci-fi world? Is it not a sci-fi world? What does the movie, like, those questions to me are really, like, I come out of a movie asking questions like that. I'm excited because the movie gets to live with me in a different way. So that's part of the reason I love this movie so much. I also disagree with some of the things that you're saying and agree with others. I actually think, to me, I like that the movie makes you waffle on whether it's real or sci-fi. It almost purposefully goes back and forth. Like you mentioned, the rock not quite hitting the window, hitting the door. Was it a force field? Was it just that he didn't hit the window? Like, so it leaves things up in the air. And then it gives you this whole thing where now they're in the same room and it's like, oh, okay. It's just the real world. It's just that these are, there's some sort of cloning process that has happened to these people that's scientific and whatever. And now they're going to have conversations and it's not really this metaphorical idealized versions of themselves. It's actual other people who, you know, have been transformed to be like them, which I think the movie is saying. And then he hits the force field and you're like, well, wait, is that sci-fi? Like, what, who's, you know, is somebody watching and putting the force field up and only letting people leave? Or is there something metaphorical going on here? I actually like all those questions. But I'm also the guy who got to the end of The Lost and was like, they answered all the questions I needed them to answer. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there was nothing I needed to know that Lost didn't answer. So I come out of this movie kind of the same way. Like, any of those things that aren't answered are fun to talk about, but they don't impact my ability to enjoy both the structural storytelling narrative of like what's actually going on in the plot as far as like what I experience with my eyes and my ears, or my ability to think about the themes and metaphors and what it's trying to say about relationships in marriage, which for me is not just about, do we prefer an idealized or previous version of the person we love, but also how we seek to find a better version of the person we love when we start to get caught up in the negatives or the things we don't like about them. So you'll see people go from relationship to relationship, and the next person they're with is great at all the things the person, you know, they were with before wasn't great at, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And so there's this element of searching for the perfect relationship that I think the movie dives into in an interesting way. And I think both of them come out of this movie realizing, again, if the switch happened, which I believe it did, just like you guys do, both of them come out of this movie eventually realizing that there is no perfect idealized version. And for him, it's a realization in a moment of, you know, the bacon or whatever, where he has to go decide, okay, well, this is my life now, even though this isn't the person that I went there with, or, you know, whatever. This isn't my perfect ending, but this is, you know, what I'm going to take. He knows that's a different person, not just a different version of his wife, actually a different person that he's with now, which I don't know. I find really interesting. I will say, definitely going through it again, I noticed some of more of the setup that they're doing with, like you mentioned, the guest house and the main house. I think the stairs are what's supposed to clue us in mostly. I noticed there were lots of shots of the stairs anytime somebody would go into one house or the other. I don't think it's executed well, though. I think you're right. I think there is, especially first time through, some confusion about, okay, which house are they in? You know, that kind of thing. I was never confused about who was, you know, Ethan and E-Twin. Like, I, you know, no, the hair and the glasses.
And no glasses. Yeah.
Made that easy. But the Elizabeth Moss character was a little confusing to me. And contextually, I was able to figure it out the first time through. But it's,
yeah,
I think that could have been done better as well. I think you're right about that. So yeah, I think it's a really rewarding rewatch, but I would never, like, if it would, you didn't enjoy it enough to watch it again, I, you know, then clearly don't. But like,
I've already watched it again, by the way.
Nice.
Yeah, I saw it twice because I think this is one of those movies, like, after the first time I was like, okay, now that I know the nature of what's going on here, I want to watch it with that in mind. So that's what I did. I watched it the second time and like, okay, now I know everything that's going on. Even then, though, it was still hard to figure out who's going where and why and all that. And the Sophies being not too different throughout the whole movie is another big issue, because you're sitting there just kind of going, wait a minute, is this the one? Is that her? I can't remember.
Well, and of course it's plot driven, you know, because they have to look the same at the end, right? Like, it can't be something so obvious that Ethan knows which one he's going. So there's a plot, there's a story reason, but yes, it is confusing. So
no, I mean, that's a plot reason at the end. It's not a plot reason for us during watching the movie while we're trying to figure out who's who in the story and everything. I understand, like, that's a thing for him at the end,
mm-hmm,
and for us, because there's very little difference between the two, even though I feel like there was a little bit of difference in hair as well, that if you looked close enough, it would tip you off at the end as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, this is a very, very, very interesting movie, and it's going to stay with me for sure. I'm always going to be, there's a lot of ideas in this movie that are, you know, really, really fun to explore.
So. Yeah. I had a couple other things I wanted to mention just that stood out to me this time through. One is, every time I watch this, I have watched this movie, I laugh so hard when they get back to the house. They see that the other two are now there with them in the house, and he turns to her and goes, "Is it weird for you now, Sophie?" It kills me every time. I don't know if it's the delivery on the line, what it is, like, you know, because she had just said to him out by the pool or whatever, "I don't find it that it's not that weird to me," or whatever. Yeah. And then they go in the house, mm-hmm, and they're both there. He just looks at her and goes, "Is it weird for you now, Sophie?" Just cracked me up.
By the way, sorry to break in,
no,
but the poker scene is something that I wish more actual movies dealing with poker would do, and that is someone calling a big, huge bet with basically nothing in their, mm-hmm, hands, instead of this, like, boy, isn't James Bond such a great gambler that he had a straight flush while everybody else had full houses and stuff like that? And isn't he awesome at poker now? But, like, this one is, like, he actually went through and read the man and said, you know, yeah, I've just got an ace. That's all I've got. I'm going to call. And he was right.
Yeah.
So, love that. Anyway.
I think one of the things we could talk about for a couple minutes eventually, here in a second, if you want to, is what we believe. Like, you said, Jeremy, something like, I can't find the narrative, what actually is going on. I think there's some interesting discussion to have there. Some things I caught with Danson, the way he's talking about it at the beginning are really interesting. He uses very specific words like, I've sent couples there to be renewed. You know, this idea that he is some sort of, you know, nefarious Saul-like, you know, figure in the movie is interesting to me, that he's maybe like the big bad, like the villain that is trapping people in this mystery house he owns, built, found, whatever it might be, is a really interesting dynamic to me.
In that first scene, I wrote this down. I wasn't sure if it was an accident or on purpose, but he says it'll give you two a chance to reset the reset button, which I thought was such strange phrasing. It almost has to be intentional. And the reset almost, is that hinting at the doppelgangers to come?
Maybe.
Or did Ted Danson just fuck up the line?
No, I think that's exactly, because the whole thing is resetting.
Yeah.
The whole situation is, because the couple they've interacted with have already been reset, and now you're resetting that as well. So that's what I believe. Now, the character may have fucked up by saying that, because that doesn't make sense if you have no context whatsoever.
Right.
I think that was intentional. So.
I also really like that this movie gets going so fast. Within 15 minutes, we're in it. Like, there's not a lot of, you know, backstory on this, backstory on that. So this, I mean, it is in 15 minutes, we have met them both at the therapy session. He sent them to the place. They're already there and they're already having the experience. Like, it's just, we're in it within 15 minutes, I think is a real good part of the movie. And of course, part of that is also how they're shooting this movie, which we've talked about, like, you know, the idea that this is a very svelte, you know, movie shooting experience where they're trying to do a lot in a little time. I already mentioned that I like how it goes from mystical to non-mystical. The moment at the beginning is an interesting comparison to the rest of the movie, analogy for the rest of the movie, an idea of something being real the first time and fake the second time. And it just doesn't quite work. You know, you try to recreate something and have an idealized version of something, but it doesn't quite work. Applies to the movie really, really well. I like that. And I couldn't help shaking the feeling at the beginning when they're first interacting with these people, that the way that these people are responding to their questions, their queries, those kind of things, is like an AI chatbot. I don't know if you've ever done like a chatbot or anything like that. And it's like, you know, you ask them a tough question. It's like, well, let me ask you a question or whatever.
Yeah.
So it reminded me a lot of that. I really like this movie. I think my personal story is that Ted Danson is the big bad, and that he is using this house for some sort of nefarious purposes. He's getting something out of it. And if nothing else, the business, but yeah.
Yeah, that's what it is. He's able to tell people, hey, I'm the best marriage counselor in the world. Mm-hmm. Look at all the success stories that I have, and probably is able to charge a bunch for it as well.
What we know is that the couples go there, two people leave, and then whoever's left behind, which is either the same people that went or the old couple that left, is what we're supposed to believe usually happens, have to wait until they can, you know, break up the new couple to be able to leave.
Does
it's interesting.
Raise the question too, is whether they are the last people to be there, by the way, because if you have these two people who love being together at the end, why would they break anybody else's relationship? Well, I guess they could break out. The point is for them to break out at the end, not necessarily. But wouldn't you want to just live that life the rest of your time? Unless you can't get food or something because you can't leave or whatever. I don't know. Maybe there's something to that.
It's also clear to me that they can spy on the other couple, like that they have access to conversations that happen in the main house and different things like that. Because they bring up some of that stuff. So I don't know. It's interesting stuff for me to think about. But I totally get the idea of feeling like I wanted something more concrete. That makes sense to me, even though I don't experience that way.
Yeah. All right. Let's go on to our super secret double features.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right. I'm gonna give one that very few people have probably seen on this, you know, out there at the chat, and I don't think you two have seen this, but the movie that it reminded me of immediately was a movie called La Moustache, and it's from it's a movie from 2005. I think it's a French movie. I have not seen it in forever, but the basic premise of it is there is a man who has a mustache and he's married to this woman, and he jokes about like cutting his mustache for the first time, and she's like, I wouldn't even recognize you without that mustache or whatever. And then he decides, I'm going to cut it. I'm already got my mind set on it and everything. So he cuts the mustache. His wife comes home, doesn't say anything about it. Doesn't say, hey, you cut your mustache or anything. And then he is sitting there going, it finally, at like 20 minutes of her not acknowledging it on her own, he says, did you not recognize that I cut off my mustache? And she goes, you never had a mustache. Oh. And so the whole movie is kind of like that throughout the whole thing. That's where he's awesome. Trying to like, he's trying to basically prove he had one and that you guys are being crazy and gaslighting me for saying I didn't have one and everything. So it's a very interesting movie that I think goes along with this one pretty well.
Yeah, that's an immediate add to the watch list. That sounds fun.
That's awesome. Yeah. I felt like, I mean, this is a really hard movie to double feature for me because I felt like I had two paths. I could either take Couple on the Rocks, goes to a vacation, weird shit happens, or doppelganger movies. I really wanted to go with the Aubrey Plaza movie, Black Bear, which is Couple on the Rocks, and a visitor that comes, and
it's weird, and it has some like what's weird. Really happening. Yeah,
you don't know what's happening. The extra weird thing is that halfway through the movie, it starts over, and everybody's playing different characters, or their roles have been changed. It's very strange. But I ended up deciding to go with Moon because I feel like the way. He responds to his doppelganger showing up. It's pretty casual, and I feel like that's how this movie starts. Duplass is kind of, I don't know, it just felt like a really good atmospheric, compatibly movie where somebody encounters a doppelganger and then has to figure out which one of us is the real us, some identity searching, some... Is the world what I think it is? I ended up deciding to go with Moon, although you should probably watch Black Bear at some point if you're into experimental.
Yeah.
I remember watching Black Bear, and I was that was a movie that I was very interested in the premise of. I don't know if I ended up liking the movie by the end of it, but I may give that another whirl at some point because it is that type of movie where you're like, maybe I should just give that another chance someday because it's one of those where you're like, what the fuck was going on that whole time?
Yeah, exactly.
So
I think Moon is an inspired choice. I think tonally those are, you know, so similar. You know, the idea of like, hey, what's going on? Oh, why am I in this weird place with somebody who looks just like me? Like, yeah, that's a great choice.
Cool.
Saw a few in the chat that were pretty interesting. Josh said Multiplicity, which is another one that I had thought of while watching this. I thought of Groundhog Day, obviously. It was, you know, just for the one scene that was in there. Cabin in the Woods because of the sort of the shield that's keeping them in that place. By the way, the sound that thing makes when he runs into it. Mm-hmm. My cats were going wild when they heard that. Cats don't really pay attention to anything that's on TV, and that sound alerted them. Castro says The Game or Date Night would be on there. I like those too. And then a vote for Us is in there. Us would be a good one as well if you're talking about doppelgangers and things like that.
Yeah.
All right. For next week, here's the next week's movie. It's my turn. My turn. I'm going to go back to 1999, yes. Since we're still in that 25 year anniversary thing, and we're going to do the docu-comedy, American Movie.
Oh.
Have you ever seen this?
Yeah, but it's been. I mean, since it came out.
I haven't seen this.
Oh my God. Talk about a joy right here. Nice. This, I can't wait. I can't wait till you see this. And I'm glad Jeremy has seen it, but if it's been a while, this is a good one to revisit.
Oh yeah, I don't remember anything except the weird pronunciation of the word coven.
Yeah, Colvin. Colvin. It focuses on filmmaker Mark Borchardt. He's a Wisconsin filmmaker who is at first he's trying to make a movie that he had abandoned years ago or whatever. I think that's what he shot some stuff, and then he decided, well, I don't have enough money to do that. Now I'm going to shoot this horror movie called Colvin, and so it follows him as he tries to make this movie and talk about some down-home Midwestern characters you're going to meet when you're watching this one. Mark Borchardt is a big one. His buddy there in the chair that I can't, Mike Shank, something like that. He's a character. Everybody's kind of a character in this, and the movie doesn't shy away from their foibles or anything like that. If you ever get your hands on the DVD or whatever of this movie, I don't know if it's out there. I don't know. I may avoid saying what I was going to say because might be a spoiler. I will talk about that next week when we talk about American Movie, what I was going to say there. Cliffhanger. all right. So, all right, that's going to do it for this week. Once again, chat, thank you guys for coming out and bringing it again. My God, you guys had a good conversation going on there about the one I love. And none of us broke out into the REM song during this whole time. I pat myself on the back.
As you should. As you should.
Absolutely. So, but that's going to do it for this week. Next week is American Movie, and we will see you next time. See ya.
I got a wallet.
Bye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Here I am, Papa.
Go ahead and get that rocker look going down, man. That Van Halen 1985 look.
This is a bit Van Halen 85, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people will listen to these outtakes and the album is called 1984. Yeah, I know. I was picking an era, not an album.
Yeah, I like that 1985 George Orwell book too.
Yeah, the 1985 George Orwell nailed 1985, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, today that would absolutely be a book or a movie sequel or...
Yeah, exactly.
There is a book called 1985 that is a spiritual sequel to 1984. Of course there is. Written by Hungarian author Gyorgy Dalos. The novel is set after the death of Big Brother and explores the period between 1984 and a more optimistic future. Hey, you turn 1984 into a story of optimism. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, but by the end of 1984, you're like, I see a thread of hope at the end of this. The other Space Odyssey book is 2061, apparently. So they went full 60 years into the third one.
Awesome.
They need to, like, I don't know. Do they need to make a 2061 movie? And do they need to remake 2001 and 2010 to get to that?
Probably. I mean, need is such a, you know.
Well, yeah, but remaking 2001 would be such a...
It'll happen. Blasphemy. I don't know if it'll be in our lifetimes, but it'll happen.
Blasphemy, man. They'll keep the drug trippy sequence, and then everything else will be like... We'll get into Hal's inner thoughts, what he's really thinking. Like,
yeah.
I can see their lips moving.
So there are some other sequels to 1984. This is fascinating. So there was a book called Julia, that was written. Okay. This was written by Sandra Newman with the approval of the Orwell estate. The novel is told from the perspective of Julia Worthing, Winston Smith's romantic interest in 1984. Julia's story reevaluates Winston Smith in the dystopian society of Big Brother. Interesting. So kind of a female perspective on 1984, a feminist retelling, if you will.
I missed half the goddamn outtakes.
I love how in the middle of a fuck rant you put fiddlesticks in the middle of it.
It's amazing.
Fuck, fiddlestick, fuck.
So now that I'm a part of the conversation, I did want to talk before we got into the show about how wrong I think it is that Aaron finished The Penguin and didn't tell us what he thought.
Maybe I was saving it for these outtakes right here and now.
Maybe you were.
I just wanted to see you face to face.
I'm just saying, you were like one episode away a week ago, and I was like, I'm going to find out what he thinks here any day. And then you took a long time to watch it. Then you told me you were watching it actively. And instead of telling me what you thought of the episode, you'd commented on the names of the brothers.
I am almost ready to talk about it. That's how much it devastated me. That final episode absolutely destroyed me, which is exactly what it intended to do, and is just like I'm getting choked up thinking about it.
Awesome. So say no more.
Okay.
Talk when you're ready. I just wanted to make sure that you weren't like, what a letdown.
No, God. No, I
have.
Go ahead.
Good. Oh, I have been. This is not related to Penguin, so go ahead, and then I'll continue.
Oh, okay. Overall, it's astonishing television making, and it's another great example with Watchmen and, there was one other I was thinking of how you do comic source material in a way that just feels organic to a real world as opposed to, so like all the fantastical elements of the comic material just seem to fit within the authenticity of the world. So it's nothing feels out of place. I was really impressed.
No, I've done this numerous times with movies over the years where there's like the large discussion about a movie on Slack that I haven't seen. So I ignore all that stuff that goes on, ignore it completely. I can't ignore it completely because my phone does notifications. So it's constantly like bloop, 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 bloop. And God save you, Jonathan, when you're on Slack. My God, man.
I'm Rick Julius, a partner at Cordell & Cordell. Divorce is more than just a legal process. It's a life-changing event that can impact your future, finances, and your relationship with your children. You've worked hard to build a life that you're proud of, and you deserve a legal partner who will work just as hard to protect it.
Offices in Philadelphia, Radnor, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Rick Julius, licensed in Pennsylvania only. Michelle Ferrari, licensed in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Online at CordellCordell.com.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.